Well, tonight we continue our series on the existence of God. And just by way of reminder, Pastor Ron has done a series on the attributes of God. And that series is at the Grace Baptist website. So you can listen through that series on the attributes of God. And so this is kind of a companion study on the existence of God. And as you know, the Stephen Charnock is one of the primary sources I'm using for this study. He's a Puritan, English Puritan, that died in 1680, and he wrote, it's in a two-volume set, you can get it in our day, but he wrote on the existence and attributes of God. And obviously some of it is heavy lifting and deep to tread through, but it's well worth it. Another one is Herman Bovink on the doctrine of God that I'm using, a great Dutch theologian, and as well as some other sources. But some of it gets philosophical when you get into the existence of God, because we're dealing with how unbelievers think. And some of this is apologetic. So some of it is understanding how to defend your faith in God against unbelievers, those who question the existence of Yahweh, the only true and living God, as revealed in the Scriptures. But there are many around the world and in our local community that do not believe in Yahweh. And there's as many idols as there are people, if not more idols than people in our society. Well, and part of this study on the existence of God is hopefully to strengthen your faith, to understand more reasons that undergird your belief in the existence of God. I put on the board there on the top tonight, Christian theology rejects the view of innate ideas of God. Now, this at the top here is review from last time we met. Okay? And we looked at the argument from universal consent. The argument from universal consent. It's an argument from history. And doing a scientific study of history, looking at all of the tribes and nations of human beings. And a scientific study of history finds universal consent among men for the existence of God. In other words, that religion is rooted in the essence of human nature itself, as Bovink said. That's what we find scientifically. That every tribe and every nation around the world in the history of humanity has had some form of religion. As was also noted, there is in the Bible, there's not one absolute atheist recorded in the Bible. Not one. So typically what you find then is if they're not worshiping Yahweh, the I am that I am, the living and true God of the Holy Scriptures, then they are worshiping an idol. No matter what they say, they are worshiping an idol in some way or another in their life, a false god. And what the argument from universal consent shows is that man is both rational and corrupt. And that's a review as well from last time we met. So rational in the sense that a supreme being should be worshipped. They live in God's theater. They see His works around them every day. And they have the law of God written in their heart, right? We've looked at Romans 1:20, looked at Psalm 19:1 through 4. We've looked at Romans 2:14 and 15. Because God has been witnessing Himself to them both within and without, in general revelation. I mean, it's common to all people, because God, the Creator, has been witnessing and revealing Himself, testifying of His existence to human beings, both within them and without them. The law of God is written in their hearts, Romans 2, 14 and 15, as well as the creation that they see around them reveals the existence of God, His eternal power and Godhead, Romans 1, 20. So they're rational. A supreme being should be worshipped. There is a supreme being that has the right to be worshipped, but they show themselves to be corrupt because of a wrong manner and object of worship. There's idolatry all over. So they warp and twist the truth in unrighteousness. So they show that they're corrupt. Both the Bible, so the Bible we call special revelation. Out in creation, we'd call general revelation. But both the Bible and its special revelation and the consensus of church history, and we'll hopefully look at that the next time we meet, that's what I'm thinking. We'll look at a little bit of church history and theologians in church history. But the Bible and the consensus of church history assert that the natural world around us, general revelation, the natural world around us, is needed in order to bring us to a conscious knowledge of God's existence. We need the general revelation of God around us that is in nature in order to come to a knowledge of God's existence. You will not come to a knowledge of God's existence without the general revelation around you. And this truth is necessary to avoid both rationalism and mysticism, where man's mind is falsely assumed as independent of God's revelation in nature. Okay? This is where the rubber hits the road right here. Okay? And that's what we're going to be looking at here, this idea of innate ideas. Innate. Think of it this way. Because of universal consent for the existence of God, every tribe out there in the history of humanity has had a religion. This idea that there is a supreme being that needs worshiped. It's in every tribe in the history of humanity. So does that mean that we're born with that knowledge? Does it mean you're born with it? Is it innate? Is it before any experience of the world? Is it before thinking even? The idea that it's innate would be the idea that God put it there. The very idea of His being in existence before you even think, before you even experience the sun, the rain, the wind, flowers, anything around you in creation. That's the idea of an innate idea. But you can see how someone could come to a false conclusion to say, well, it must be innate then. Everybody comes to that idea, this rational idea that a supreme being should be worshipped. It's universal among all the tribes in the history of humanity. Therefore, maybe we're born with it. And if, think of the danger there. If we're born with it, do I need the Bible? Perhaps I can just go be a mystic in a monastery somewhere and do a lot of meditation with what's inside of me and the knowledge that's already there inside of me that's innate. You see? You see the danger. So this is where you're going to come across somebody. If you come across somebody that says, I don't need the Bible. Hey, all of this is common sense. It's there. I can come to a knowledge of God just naturally. And this is where we're going to say, no. No, the knowledge we have of God is an acquired knowledge through active experience and thinking. We have to experience God's general revelation around us and think about the general revelation around us, in addition to read his scriptures, right? What do the scriptures principally teach? What man is to believe concerning God, and what duty God requires of man? About the existence of God and his being, who he is, right? But we have to then read it and then think about it. It's active, acquired knowledge. It's not innate. It takes study. It takes thinking. So we want to avoid rationalism and mysticism, is another way of saying it. Because with rationalism and mysticism is the idea that the knowledge of God is innate. Before thinking and before experience, it's there. Rationalism and mysticism falsely assumes that man's mind is independent of God's revelation in nature. Rationalism assumes that man's mind is the source of truth. It's innate. See, these ideas are innate in their view, and that's false. Back to Romans 1, 19 and 20. Let's turn to Romans 1, 19 and 20. Romans 1, 19 and 20. Hear now the words of God. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. God has manifest these things in them, for he has shown it to them. He's shown it to them, and they have to think about it. By the things that are made, in verse 20, things that are clearly seen. That means your eyes are a part of your sensory perception. Right? Things you hear, taste, touch, feel, smell, right? These are sense perception, right? That's what he's getting at then. Through sense perception, by the things that are made, then we understand things about God, mediated through the things that are made. It's what's called a mediate knowledge, through a medium. It's not immediate, okay? We'll be talking more about that as well, hopefully. Okay, so the knowledge we have of God is a knowledge that is mediate. It is through a means, a medium of communication, and that is his works of creation. It's not just him directly putting the idea in us before we experience anything. And we'll talk more about that as well. Here's what Charnock says, okay? The apostle does not say, this is a direct quote, the apostle does not say the invisible things of God are believed or they have an opinion of them, but that they are seen and clearly seen. I'll read it again. The apostle does not say the invisible things of God are believed or they have an opinion of them, but that they are seen and clearly seen in the smallest creature to the largest. from Genesis chapter 1. By the things that are made. By the things that are made. From the smallest creature to the largest. From galaxies to stars to one-celled bacteria to DNA to atoms, electrons, protons. From the blue whale to the ant. This is this idea of the media. The media. As R.C. Sproul would say, why do we call it the news media? When we hear the news. The news media, because they communicate through a medium. Whether that be radio, television, the internet, it's through a medium. They're media. So that's where God communicates to us through a medium, through his works of creation. See? Through the scriptures, through mediums and things that are the media that are communicated through. So the knowledge we have is through a particular means. And Romans 1:20 is saying it is the things that we see, our sense perception of things God has created. Psalm 8:1. Psalm 8:1 says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who have set your glory above the heavens. How excellent is your name in all the earth. God's name is excellent, and his attributes are seen in all the earth. Not that God is the earth. No. It's not pantheism. But these are the very works of God. And you understand things about the artist and the craftsman by studying the work. Right? People who study paintings know that about Manet or other painters. You say, well, they had certain ways of flaring paint and doing different things, and you understand things about their wisdom and their flair and their artistry and beauty, right? Through the medium. It's communicated through the means of their works. So men, so what Romans 1, 19 and 20 is saying is men are they're inexcusable if they have not some knowledge of God by them. They're without excuse. It's inexcusable. They're without excuse if they have not some knowledge of God by them. Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So if they do not have some knowledge of God by them, they're without excuse. It is absolutely clear. The testimony and revelation of God in his existence by his works of creation and providence. Think of Solomon. Okay, this is an illustration. Give you an example. Solomon, King Solomon, right? He was a young man. He's going to become king. And God said, what would you like me to give you? And he asked for wisdom to be able to judge rightly among the people, right? And God blessed him and said, because you didn't ask for personal wealth and these other things, I'll add that on top of it all for you as a blessing, because you asked for wisdom, right? Well, go to 1 Kings 10:24. I'll read verse 23 with it. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. Now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Now one thing Solomon studied was God's wisdom in God's works of creation, his works of nature. It's one thing Solomon studied. He was a scientist. Go to 1 Kings 4. And it's in 1 Kings 3 there is that history. And where the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night in 1 Kings 3, 5, and said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" Right? Well, then you go down to 1 Kings 3, 9. "Therefore, give to your servant," Solomon says, "an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" And then God says in verse 11, 1 Kings 3, "Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, you have not asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice." What? To be a good servant for the good of the people. He was unselfish. "So therefore, behold, I have done according to your word. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart." Right? As well, God blesses him with all the rest. Now, look here, though, at 1 Kings 4, 33 and 34. I'll read verse 32 with it. Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs. His songs were 1,005. Also, he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Think as well, Proverbs 6, this is one example from Proverbs. Proverbs 6, Solomon studying creation, God's wisdom in God's works of nature. Here, Proverbs 6, 6 through 11 is one example. "Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man." Go to the ant and gain some wisdom. Solomon gained wisdom from studying more than just God's special revelation in the Scriptures. Look at Deuteronomy 4. Deuteronomy 4, 5 through 8. So Solomon has the Mosaic Law, right? Solomon has the Mosaic Law. What did Moses here write? Deuteronomy 4, 5 through 8. "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me," Moses writes, "that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom, and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I have set before you this day? Go over in the Torah of Deuteronomy, look at Deuteronomy chapter 17. Verses 18 and 20. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 18 and 20. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that's when Israel gets earthly kings like Solomon, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites, who kept a copy themselves, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, which are filled with wisdom, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. But in those statutes that he was to write out by hand a copy of the Torah of Deuteronomy is contained the very wisdom of God, applying the Ten Commandments to the detailed life in the agricultural society of ancient Israel. So there you have Solomon the king. He's supposed to be making a copy of himself, of the Torah of Deuteronomy, reading it every day, meditating upon it every day, gaining wisdom from it. He's also studying God's creatures, large and small, right? And cedar trees down to ants and you name it. He's studying creatures, gaining wisdom from God by the things that have been made. And this idea is what is clearly seen as outside of us. I'll give you an example. Okay, we have this in our day and age. People don't give glory to God, though. Velcro. Velcro, right? Lots of people use Velcro. It's the zipperless zipper, huh? Exists on all sorts of products, right? From children's shoes, laptop bags, blood pressure gauges, airplane floating devices, and we can go on and on and on, right? Countless things we have Velcro on. It was inspired by nature, observing the wisdom that's there in God's works of nature. In 1948, a Swiss engineer went hiking in the woods with his dog. Upon arriving back at his home, he took note of the burrs that clung to his clothes, and he wondered if such an idea could be useful in commercial application. He studied a burr under a microscope only to discover that they were covered in tiny hooks, which allowed them to grab onto clothes and fur that brushed in passing. After more than 8 years of research and work, he created what is known now today as Velcro, a combination of the words velvet and crochet. Made up of two strips of fabric, one covered in thousands of tiny hooks and the other with thousands of tiny loops. The materials gripped together firmly while still allowing easy release. But he studied a burr, a work of creation, and the wisdom that's there. I mentioned it before. You think of how water is purified. How water is purified. You know, most bottled water is, like the one in my hand here, is purified water. And typically, it's through a microfiltration process, reverse osmosis, yeah? Reverse osmosis, and all that's doing is copying nature as well and the wisdom of God and how he purifies our drinking water that's stored in the ground. Well, the water that it just rained outside this evening, that water infiltrates the soil. All different types of soil have different infiltration capacities. And whatever overseeds, if it overseeds and is the rain's greater than the infiltration capacity of runoff, right? runoff, it goes right to the rivers. But within the infiltration capacity of the soil, it starts percolating down through the soil and it gets filtered. It starts getting cleansed and purified as it's filtering through the soil. We also have that with the purification of water, with when we use distillation processes. Some of the purest water you can have, even some in medical procedures. We mimic nature and the wisdom that's there in nature, where water evaporates. So you think of the water out here that gets into a pool out here on our parking lot that has oil in it, another gunk, right? But then the water goes from a liquid state to a gas when it evaporates, right? It gets some sunshine tomorrow, it's going to evaporate. It becomes pure water and leaves behind all the gunk. Absolute pure water vapor. Goes up, continues to rise as it gets higher in the troposphere, the air gets cooler, it condenses on small particles, dust, coalesces into raindrops, right? And then eventually falls back down to the ground again, purified. Through a distillation process, we mimic that as well to purify water, where you boil it, right? You heat it up, you boil it, you turn the liquid into a vapor, and then you send it through a pipe down to another area where you cool it again, and it condenses back to water, pure water. But we're mimicking the wisdom that's there in nature. But this is Solomon as well, you see. And there's all sorts. You can get it. There's a lot of different inventions that we have. We call them inventions, but all they're doing is copying the wisdom of God in nature, right? Through things that are clearly seen. Oh, is our God, He is a wise God. Eternal power and Godhead and wisdom are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, so that men are without excuse. As well, Romans 2, 14 and 15, we've referred to this, of what is written on our hearts. Even the Gentiles had the law of God written in their hearts, so they show the work of the law. Right? They show the work of the law. They're corrupt, so they warp it and they twist it. But they show that, well, for the most part, they want to be honest. For the most part, they think stealing's bad. For the most part, they think murder's not good. But they create a lot of exceptions. Like in abortion, they've had 60 million exceptions since Roe v. Wade. As we've said in the Western Civ class, American Western Civ, rational secular humanism was most vivid in the USSR, communism, communist regime of the Soviet Union. But communism, it is said, murdered probably 100 million people in the 20th century. But neo-paganism in our day, so rational, atheistic, rational secular humanism in the 20th century murdered 100 million people, but neo-paganism, after the 1960s Cultural Revolution, this neo-paganism idolatry has murdered 60 million on behalf of the sexual revolution. But again, they show the work of the law. For the most part, they say, yeah, you know, you shouldn't murder somebody. But for them, they don't think life begins until either at birth or after birth, almost, in the state of New York and other areas of the Western world right now. But as Martin Luther and John Calvin believe, the Ten Commandments are written in human hearts. That's the law written on human hearts. We're created in the image of God. So the law is there, but note, it's not the knowledge of God, but the law of God that's written there. The law is a witness to God, who is the lawgiver, which the human mind must rationally conclude exists. We are a part of nature as well. So I include that there to say, okay, even that, though, is technically not an innate idea of God. You see, what's written in the human heart is the law of God, which witnesses and testifies to the existence of God, the lawgiver. flip the board around here. Now, we're going to get through kind of a short summary of philosophical thought. That's what this is, of secular philosophical thought on innate ideas. Okay? The root of innate ideas goes back to Greek philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy. That's where the root of it, the seeds of it began, even though they themselves didn't embrace full-blown innate ideas. But the seed, the beginning notions of it, began in ancient Greek philosophy. So here's what I wrote on the top of the board here. The natural universal knowledge of God from creation, universal consent, we looked at last time we met, the argument from universal consent, gives the false impression that man is born with this knowledge or idea of God's existence, right? That's what I've shared already. Since every tribe in the history of humanity has religion, believes there's a supreme being that has the right to be worshipped, it gives the false impression that you're born with this idea of God's existence. And this view of innate ideas is which Christianity rejects. So that's the view of innate ideas which Christianity rejects. Now I put 2 Corinthians 10, 4 and 5 on the board. Turn to 2 Corinthians 10, 4 and 5. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, not earthly, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So every argument and every high, lofty opinion that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, we have a weapon, and that weapon is the Word of God, the sword of the Spirit, Ephesians 6:17. And it is mighty for pulling down these strongholds. There are thoughts that are raged up against Christianity. And again, rationalism and mysticism are two forms of high and lofty opinions raised up against the knowledge of God. Because both rationalism and mysticism say, you don't need to go to the Bible. You don't even need to study the works of creation. These ideas are innate. That's their false notion. You're born with those ideas. That's their false notion. So this the view of innate ideas is rooted in Greek philosophy as it pondered how and why we know something. How and why do we know something? That's referred to as epistemology. The science of knowledge. How do we know something? What are the limits of human knowledge? Epistemology. So the ancient Greeks they studied both metaphysics and epistemology. Metaphysics, the study of the ultimate physical things, ultimate being. What has become the great crisis of modernity and postmodernity has been epistemology. How do you know what you know? You've probably had people tell you that if you start sharing with them certain things about Christianity, about God, about Christ, about the Bible. And they say, how do you know that? Well, how do you know that? Well, how do you know that? And they just keep pressing you. You know, do we really know anything? But They live life as a bunch of skeptics, as if nothing can be known with certainty. Well, the ancient Greeks were pondering how you know something and why you know something. There's really two possibilities. Okay, this is from Bovink, okay, Hermann Bovink, The Doctrine of God. Is two possibilities. Number one, we know something innately. Nothing more to learn. It's innate. It's in our minds, the ideas, before we think, before we experience reality around us, before we have see, taste, touch, and hear anything, you just know it. So there's nothing more to learn in that idea. Now that's false. Christianity rejects that. Number two, the second possibility, we do not know it. So then the question is, how do we strive to know it? Right? So then how do you know it? Right? That's two possibilities. Either we know something innately, we're born with it, so there's nothing more to learn, or we do not know it. And then the question is, how do we strive to know it? Right? Makes sense. Now, I put over here on the side, why have a class on ethics? Why did I put that there? Some of you know I've taught with Indiana Wesleyan University for 19 years, both graduate and undergraduate courses, in a lot of different things related with law and with business and management. But sometimes I teach a class related with ethical and legal issues in management at the graduate level. And I typically, it's interesting, my father-in-law, like if he hears, oh, Ryan's teaching this class again on this, and they go, well, why have that? It's just all common sense. Why do they have to have a class on ethics? It should be common sense. The dilemma then is you're kind of falling into this sense of it's innate. You see what I'm saying? In Romans chapter 2 there, verses 14 and 15, on the front side of the board, I'd put at the very bottom, Romans 2, 14 and 15, where the Gentiles who don't have the Scriptures, the Bible, they show the work of God's law written in their hearts, right? But the work, they're sinners. So it comes out in a warped fashion. It's bent, it's warped, it's twisted. Yeah, I tell the truth, but, you know, a little white lie here and there is okay. You know, you warp it and twist it. Well, this is where we need to study ethics because we're sinners. And we don't, even though it's written on our hearts, we've suppressed it and held it down so that we're very confused in our sin, in our darkened mind and understanding. So we have to study it. This is the idea, right? We're without excuse. God's written it in our heart. We're without excuse. It's out here in creation. We live in the theater of God. We're without excuse for not having a knowledge of God, right? And for not obeying like we should the law of God. We're without excuse. There's no excuses. He's been revealed everything clear to us. But we're sinners. Which is why then, in another sense, we don't. Right? It's not innate. We're not born with it. The idea of God, we don't know it. So how do we know it? Even this, we've got to study. Right? Study God's Word. Study the things that have been made. Well, here's a very short summarized form of philosophy on this issue, in the history of philosophy. Plato. Plato died 347 BC. 347 BC. So he lived about 400 years before Christ. Okay. Plato proposed, and this is in Greece, so in Athens in southern Europe, Plato proposed his view of remnances, that he called it, remnances. For him, this is what he assumed. He's just a secular rational thinker, okay? He said, before the soul was joined to the body, so he believed we have a non-material part, a soul, and we have a physical part, a body. But he said, before the soul was joined to the body, it beheld the essence and beauty of everything. And in its stored memory, in its memory that's it stored the imprints of these ideas, of the essence and beauty of everything. For Plato, the system of mathematics is built on this. He was a mathematician. He had the idea that only mathematicians should go to his school. So he was an idealist. That's one way of saying it for him. That ideas are real. The universals, the ideas are real. There's more than just particulars. Like that's a particular chair, that's a particular table, but there's this idea of tableness. There's the idea of chairness that you in your mind immediately knows the difference between a chair and a table, between the idea of a chair and the idea of a table. Your mind immediately knows that. Well, how? This is where he's trying to think through this and say, well, you know, maybe the soul preexisted the body and the soul beheld all of the essence and beauty of everything. So it has the perfect idea of everything stored in memory. And then mathematics is built upon that. Okay. So that's Plato. Okay. He's developing his secular philosophical system of thinking. So you can get, though, where the notion of something, though, is before you're born. You see this. That the soul preexisted the body, that before you're born, this idea that you know certain things. You see that? So there's that, the beginning of an innate idea is rooted there. You see that? So Aristotle, who was the teacher of Alexander the Great, Aristotle died in 322 BC, and he regarded sense perception as the way to knowledge. What does that mean, right? Through things we see, taste, touch, feel, smell, through our senses, our physical senses, sense perception, as the way to knowledge. How do you know something? Well, I observe it. I handle it. I measure it. Through my senses, I hear it. I listen. I see, I observe, right? Through observation, through scientific observation. So he said this, regarded sense perception as the way to knowledge. So Alexander the Great, whom he taught on his military campaigns, took a lot of scientists along to collect things of nature. It was very scientific. So he's disagreeing, you see, with Plato. So Plato, you have more idealism or rationalism. With Aristotle, you have more empiricism, in a sense, okay, of being empirical, of being scientific. So, again, Aristotle regarded sense perception as the way to knowledge. For Aristotle, certain very general principles were inherent in human reason. And by means of sensation and reflection, knowledge is obtained. So we sense things through our physical senses, through scientific observation, and then we reflect with our mind upon them. Combining things or abstracting things, saying how they're similar or different, and then we're gaining knowledge, right? But certain very general principles seem to be inherent in human reason. He is the one who discovered As R.C. Sproul would say, Aristotle did not invent the law of non-contradiction or the law of causation. Laws of logic. Aristotle didn't invent it, but he discovered these principles of thinking, of human reason, these laws of thought that don't give you any knowledge, but they govern how we think. That a fish is not a book and a book is not a fish. Why? The logical law of non-contradiction. Something cannot be what it is and not what it is at the same time, or in the same relationship. So a book is not a fish and a fish is not a book. I had a professor in graduate school, Dr. Kikasola, who was educated at Westminster Theological Seminary in the 1960s. In his opinion, Aristotle was the one closest to Christian thinking. Sense perception is the way to knowledge through the things that are seen. Right? By the things that are seen, we come to understand knowledge of God. Right? You see? Right? Through sense perception and then reflection, thinking about what we see out there. Studying the ant. Studying burrs. Studying how water is purified. Huh? Oh, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Just reflecting on that, right? Okay, so that's Aristotle. So he differed from Plato. The Stoics, you remember they're mentioned when Paul, the Apostle Paul, is in the marketplace at Athens, and he comes across the Epicureans and Stoics. Rome, that's where Rome still had, some of these were ancient Greek philosophers, but their thinking continued even into the Roman Empire in many areas. Well, the Stoics were founded by Zeno in roughly 300 BC, roughly 300 years before Christ. They spoke of, quote, common natural ideas, unquote, and they spoke of, in quote, ingrafted preconceptions, unquote. That was the Stoics. Common natural ideas and ingrafted preconceptions. And for the Stoics, we derive these from physical sensation. So they inevitably come from physical sensation. Experiencing and seeing and hearing the world around us. Bavinck notes this, that none of these, Plato, Aristotle, or the Stoics, none of them held to innate ideas in the strictest sense. That ideas are present before the use of human reason, before thinking. Cicero, we get to the turn from the Roman Republic into the Roman Empire. Cicero died 43 BC, so about 50 years before Christ. Cicero accepted a knowledge of various truths that goes before all experience. Cicero accepted a knowledge of various truths that goes before all experience. This is what Cicero spoke of. Quote, notions impressed upon the mind, engrafted or innate thoughts, unquote. Engrafted or innate thoughts, unquote. When we get into the Enlightenment, we've said in the America and Western Civ class, Descartes died in 1650. So here he is at the beginning of the philosophical Enlightenment. He's a rationalist. He first spoke of innate ideas. He's the one who said that famous phrase, I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore, I am. That's Descartes. Okay? But he first spoke of innate ideas. He's the one who really first spoke of innate ideas. Real ideas, to have complex ideas of things that are innate, that are there already, before thinking, before experience. Whereas Cicero spoke of innate thoughts or notions. From Cicero, who died in 43 BC. Descartes said that the idea of God is the chief innate idea. So there are individuals within the philosophical enlightenment that believed in the existence of God. Descartes said that the idea of God is the chief innate idea. Now, Christianity rejects the idea of the innate idea of God. You will not, in other words, Descartes saying you can sit just by yourself in a room and you don't need anything else and you have the innate idea of God. And then you can just start reasoning and thinking from there. You don't need the Bible. You don't need nature around you. You don't need anything else. And then another fellow, Leibniz, he died in 1716. He followed Descartes. He further explained and expounded and expanded on Descartes' innate ideas. Immanuel Kant died 1804 AD. So you have he died right at the end of the philosophical enlightenment. Okay? And he said some knowledge is before experience and some knowledge is after experience. Why is he doing that? Why is he trying to develop a philosophical system to say some knowledge is before experience and some knowledge is after experience? It's because what's happened at the end of the Enlightenment period, there's a crisis of epistemology. How do you know what you know? Because rationalism has come up short with problems. Empiricism has come up short with problems. They're the two main ways of acquiring knowledge that were in the philosophical enlightenment period from 1600 to 1800, but they were both had critics and they had weaknesses in their systems of thought. If you boil all things down to innate ideas and reasoning from it, or you boil all things down to experience and you're born with a blank slate, that's John Locke down here. He's a true empiricist that says you're born with nothing, no innate idea, no nothing. No principles, no nothing. And then all knowledge to him comes from physical senses, derived from experience. But the dilemma is they all had then weaknesses. They all came up short in trying to develop a moral system and developing a belief in God and all of that. Those people, if they went to the Bible, they would only quote things from the Bible if it confirmed what they already found to be true, either through human reason or through experience. That's the only reason why they would quote the Bible. You find John Locke, quoting the Bible a whole lot in his writings, in his treatises concerning government, on religious toleration. He quotes the Bible a lot, but he's only quoting the Bible when it's confirming what he's already found to be true through his empiricism. So here you have, because of the weakness of both empiricism and rationalism, they're like falling short. So then Kant's like trying to save the day, Immanuel Kant, dying in 1804, but he said some knowledge is before experience and some knowledge is after experience, trying to combine a synthesis of rationalism and empiricism is what he's trying to do. Synthesize them together. And this view of innate ideas goes even further beyond Descartes and Leibniz, is the idealism of the two Germans here. Fichte died in 1814, and Hegel died in 1831. They said all knowledge and all being were innate, derived from the thought process. Pure idealism, absolute pure idealism. They've taken Plato to the nth degree, you know. At the bottom, I put empiricists like John Locke, died 1704, assert that the physical senses give rise to all knowledge. So he obviously, John Locke, rejected innate ideas because he's an empiricist. All knowledge is derived from experience. Nothing is innate to him, not even principles of thought. Now, where we're going in this, okay? This obviously, you know, I'm okay if you didn't write this stuff down and all the philosophical stuff, obviously, because. But at times you can run into some people like this in your journeys through America. There's a lot of false thinking out there all over America. But we're moving. What we'll be moving to is to be able to see that God has created us in such a way in His image that there are certain principles within us as created in the image of God that when we're born, we're growing and maturing from a baby into an infant into an adolescent, and we're seeing God's created world. And what the scriptures are telling us is every single person in the normal process of development is without excuse. Meaning, we do have the principles within us, understanding the law of causation, understanding the law of non-contradiction, which everyone lives by. Every time you stop at a red light, at the intersection, you're following the law of non-contradiction. Every time, because you're saying, well, it's red, it's not green. Red cannot be green at the same time. Okay? If you don't believe in the law of non-contradiction, just run every light. How foolish would that be, right? No, we all, even though we don't understand it, we think with the law of non-contradiction, same with the law of causation. The next time you get a sore side and you think about going to the doctor, what are you thinking? Oh, I hope the doctor will figure out the cause of this. Right? You're thinking immediately of cause and effect, right? This is where we get into the cosmology argument for God's existence, that He's the ultimate unmoved first mover, that every effect has a cause. And here we have creation that is an effect, and there's an ultimate cause, and that's God. Right? But there's this whole sense that we're wired a certain way with certain principles within us to acquire knowledge. And we will acquire the knowledge of God. Romans 1, we'll end with this again. So that's where we'll be going and building a little bit more on that. And I hope to also spend a bit on the internal testimony of the Holy Spirit, that doctrine within Christianity, just so we properly understand that. The internal testimony of the Holy Spirit. Because that's another one kind of related to this with the doctrine of innate ideas. But look at Romans 1:21. Look at Romans 1:21. Because though they knew God. They knew God. They knew God. They did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful. They suppressed and held down the truth and unrighteousness. This is their guilt. This is their shame. This is their sinfulness. They are responsible. But they knew God in the sense that they know there is a Creator. And look down at Romans 1:28. They do not like to retain God in their knowledge. Romans 1:28. They do not like to retain God in their knowledge. They know God. We're created in the image of God. You cannot erase that fact. No one can. And in the normal course of development, we will come to a knowledge of God, that there is a supreme being who exists who ought to be worshipped and honored and thanked. And everyone's responsible for not truly honoring God and giving Him thanks. But the knowledge of God itself is not innate. It's through the things that have been made that are clearly seen that we come to a knowledge of God. And everyone has. Okay, so Lord willing, then we'll continue on and go for a little bit more on this topic the next time we meet, Lord willing.